Right, so the focus in the next couple of weeks is on Catherine Mansfield. I want to say a little bit about the short story as a genre beforehand and say something about the modernist short story in particular. And I want to do that because I'm conscious that when you come to the second assignment, then you might well want to go beyond the taught material. And, of course, you get kind of recognition for that in our criteria. If you look at the criteria, it says, the best pieces of writing will go beyond the taught material. So, if you want to write about a short story and you can include somebody other than Catherine Mansfield, then that's all to the good. So I'll say a little bit about that to give you some context on this. That's Catherine Mansfield there. A short and ultimately rather tragic life, I think, for her. But one which left us a legacy of some fantastic short stories. Also, I meant to do a link to this, and I'll do it when I've got time. There's a new discovery of some unpublished Catherine Mansfield short stories that a student, actually a PhD student, made last year, and they are now going to appear, or have already appeared, I think, in the collected short stories of Catherine Mansfield, which appeared at the end of last year, or is about to appear, I'm not quite sure, one or the other. So she's actually quite an interesting character. She's quite current in terms of the kind of focus of scholars. There is Catherine Mansfield Society. There is more scholarly articles appearing on her than they used to. So she's sort of moving up the league table, if you like, in terms of attention from scholars. So, in this talk, I want to say something about what the short story is, because I think it's useful to get some basic definitions in our head. Say something about what modernists consider to be their approach to short fiction. I'm calling it short fiction rather than short story because, although the generic term is short stories, quite often these stories defy some of the conventions of the traditional short story. And then move on to say something about Catherine Mansfield, and in particular those stories, Bliss, The Garden Party, and I should have put at the end of that, Je ne parle pas français as well, so a little bit about that. Then what we'll do in our classes this week, we will pick up some of the points from today in our talk afterwards, the one-hour session that we've got after this, and then on Friday we'll go more into detail about those three stories. Okay, so some definitions. If you're like me and you want a definition, you would go to an authoritative source. So obviously Wikipedia. No, not Wikipedia at all. Don't do that. Go to something like the Oxford Dictionary of Literary Terms, and there you will find Chris Baldick, the author of that esteemed volume. And this is what he has to say about what a short story is. And the thing that strikes me about this is how vague it is, really. It doesn't really get us very much forward, does it, if we think about it? He says it's a fictional prose tale of no specified length. No specified length. Well, that doesn't really get us very far, does it? Too short to be published as a volume on its own, as novellas sometimes and novels usually are. So, okay, it's prose fiction, and it's shorter than a novel, shorter than a novella. You might then have an argument about what's a novella. And if you looked up what a novella is, then you'll probably find Chris Baldick saying, well, a novella is a piece of short prose fiction that's longer than a short story, but shorter than a novel. So we're not really getting that much further. He then says it will normally concentrate on a single event with only one or two characters. And it's more economical than a novel sustained exploration of social background. Well, clearly, that's kind of goes without saying, doesn't it? If you've got, say, 15 pages, then you are not going to be able to go into the detail that you might do if you had 500 pages. But it really doesn't get as much further forward as to what the essence is. What is it? He then makes some parallels with other forms of short fiction, fables, lays, folk tales, parables, the French conte, which is just really a French word for a short story. But then he makes an interesting point, I think. The short story as we know it flourished in the magazines of the 19th and early 20th centuries. And actually, for our purposes, this is quite interesting, because if we think of modernism as beginning to flourish at the beginning of the 20th century, then it's interesting that there's this form, the short story, which becomes very popular and very prevalent round about the same time. And the reason for that, I think, is relatively straightforward. In the middle of the 19th century onwards, you've got an explosion of print culture. You've got, because it becomes more easy to produce industrially, it becomes more easy to produce magazines and newspapers and so on. And because people are more literate than they used to be, so there's a market for these things, what you find is people, Charles Dickens would be a good example, producing these popular magazines, and of course, what they need to fill those magazines is content. And the content that they often lit upon in the end was the short story. So it became defined, really, in those magazines of the late 19th century. So, for example, if you're doing Victorian literature this year, as I know quite a few of you will be doing, you'll be doing Victorian prose, then you might well encounter some of those sorts of short stories. And if you think of somebody like Arthur Conan Doyle writing the Sherlock Holmes stories, where did they originally appear? Well, they originally appeared in the pages of the Strand magazine, which was a popular magazine at the end of the 19th century. People like Joseph Conrad, usually thought of as a modernist, his stories are appearing in Blackwood's magazine, again, a popular magazine aimed at a certain audience, which contained lots of stories like this. So, the short story, when our modernists come to look at the short story, it's actually a relatively recent development. I mentioned Dickens. If we go back to Dickens, it's quite significant, I think. Dickens, of course, you'll know, wrote these voluminous novels. The classic Victorian three-volume novel goes on even longer than Ulysses, if you can imagine that. When he came to write his stories, Christmas stories are the ones that he's most well-known for, and I think it's the law that everybody has to study The Signalman in school these days, one of Dickens' short stories. What he said about writing these stories was, he talked about the narrow space within which it was necessary to confine the stories. And he found this a bit of a problem, the narrow space, because that rendered their construction a matter of some difficulty. I could not attempt great elaboration of detail, he says. So he's actually kind of agreeing with what Baldick says in that definition, which is that in order to produce the short story, he's got to get rid of quite a few of the things that Dickens is well known for, that kind of elaboration, that kind of detail, those sort of comic set pieces where he goes on forever, goes off and digresses all over the place. Can't do any of that in a short story. And he actually finds that very difficult. But it does, for our purposes, it does define what it is that the short story is doing. It's cutting down on extraneous detail. It's not actually going to go into, it's not going to present you with an elaborate plot. It simplifies things, maybe. Although, you could say, actually, in some of the modernist short stories, the brevity actually complicates matters, and we'll come to that when we discuss Catherine Mansfield. A few 20th century thoughts about the short story. This is a quotation from Nadine Gordimer, South African novelist and short story writer, Nobel Prize winner. She says, short story writers see by the light of the flash. The present moment is what she says is a short story. And that's an interesting point, I think. This idea of the short story being a kind of snapshot, that you're not going to see what's happening before, you might not necessarily see what happens afterwards. It's more, you know, just a kind of candid little snapshot. You imagine if you're taking a picture, you know, this is not a posed group picture. This is just a snap. This is just somebody grabbing their camera and just making a very quick photograph. A couple of other people developed that sort of idea, talking about focusing the short story on a single event. If you go back to Joyce's short stories in Dubliners, Joyce had this theory that each of his stories contained what he called an epiphany. In other words, a kind of light bulb moment, if you like. A moment when somebody realises something. And it might not be terribly significant. It might not be something where you know, their life is changed. You know, it's not necessarily a death or something like that. But it's a moment where perhaps people mature, or perhaps where people have an insight into how life is. He thought that was the essence of it. William Trevor, who's a great short story writer, contemporary short story writer, this is from an interview in the Paris Review. He talked about the art of the glimpse, which is similar to what Nadine Gordimer says, the light of the flash. It's the same kind of idea, isn't it? You're just glimpsing something. It's just something that you see very quickly. That's what needs to be captured in a short story. Elizabeth Bowen, a great modernist short story writer, talks about how less it, she says, the peaks of common experience are what the short story should contain. She's talking about how the short story, again, as Dickens had it, you know, would strip away all those sorts of detail and just go for the essence of something. And going back to, you know, sources which are going to give you definitions, the Concise Oxford Companion says, the evocation of the larger human condition through a distillation of behaviour and experience is a defining feature of the great short story. So this idea then of suggesting something larger through actually presenting something smaller is what the short story seems to be about. Now, as I say, the short story gets established as a popular form at the sort of mid to end of the 19th century. So when our modernists come along, beginning of the 20th century, it's a relatively new form. But like we saw last week, and as we can see actually all the way through this module, we'll see that they challenge the conventions, they try and turn things around, they try and make it new and make it different. So, for example, Virginia Woolf has a short story set in a garden, which is seen from the point of view of a snail, which you perhaps wouldn't expect, you know. And there are, you know, other short stories by our modernist writers which challenge the whole nature of perception, the whole way in which we perceive the world. Catherine Mansfield, possibly not quite as much as that. So I've got some a lineup there of writers that you might look at. Obviously, Mansfield we're looking at in detail. Virginia Woolf, we'll be looking at her novel Mrs. Dalloway later on. And a couple of others, Elizabeth Bowen, I've already mentioned, Jean Rhys, is also a useful source for the modernist short story, and Joyce, of course, in Dubliners. So you've got a decent lineup there, if you like, and we're going to home in on Catherine Mansfield in a minute. If we think about what modernist short story does, There's a few things, and they sort of chime with modernist praxis generally. The modernist short story, like all of the modernist writing, is a focus for experimentation. Even Ulysses, will be perhaps taken aback to realise, began as a short story. Joyce was experimenting with how to render consciousness in a short story. A couple of other things that are perhaps worth pointing out. If you go back to what we think of as those sort of classic short stories of the late 19th century, the Arthur Conan Doyle ones, for example, then obviously part of the impact of those short stories is the definite sense of closure. Sherlock Holmes will solve the case. Things will be brought to a conclusion. Not necessarily the case in the modernist short story. I'm just going back to some of those phrases, the art of the glimpse. That kind of idea is very much prevalent in the modernist short story. So if you use Umberto Eco's idea of open and closed forms, what we have in the modernist short story is what he would call an open form. In other words, one which doesn't tend to lead to a natural conclusion. One which maybe leaves things open, things unresolved. You don't quite know what the ending signifies. The story ends because the story ends on the final page of the story, clearly. But, what the actual narrative, what the plot, what those characters are going to do afterwards, that is unresolved quite often. The other thing, of course, which we will come back to over and over again, I think, is this attempt to render the texture of human consciousness, not just in the novel, as we'll see in Ulysses, as we'll see in Mrs. Dalloway, as we'll see in The Good Soldier, but in the short story too. And I mentioned that phrase, and I'm at the risk of boring you with that phrase, the ordinary mind on an ordinary day. This is Virginia Woolf's phrase from Modern Fiction that we mentioned last week, in which she tries to set out as a kind of manifesto statement what it is that she thinks prose fiction should be about. She's talking about the novel, but she could equally be talking about short stories too. And just to emphasise what she says, and I think I read this to you last week, but just to recap on it. She says, imagine for a moment an ordinary mind on an ordinary day. The mind receives a myriad impressions, trivial, fantastic, evanescent, or engraved with the sharpness of steel. From all sides they come, an incessant shower of innumerable atoms. And as they fall, as they shape themselves into the life of Monday or Tuesday, the accent falls differently from of old. The moments of importance came not here, but there. And then she goes on to say what it is that she wants to do in order to take account of that fact in her writing. So she's suggesting, isn't she, that when we walk about, when we experience life, our heads aren't empty. There are all kinds of things going on up there. And I'm sure it's the case with all of us now. I would like to think that you're all 100% focused on the modernist short story. But I don't think you are. I think there are all kinds of things going on in people's heads, You're regretting what you had for breakfast, or you're wishing you did have a breakfast, or you're thinking it's too hot or it's too cold in here, or whatever. All kinds of things are going on in our heads all the time. What Virginia Woolf suggests the novelist's job, or the prose fiction writer's job, is to do, is to try and represent that on the page. Frankly, I think this is a thankless task. I don't think she's got a hope in hell of doing that. Because, as she points out, it's a myriad of things that are going on. It's all of these things crowding into people's heads all the time. How can you possibly get all of that onto the page? How can you represent that? I don't think you can, but she has a go. And so what she says is, interestingly using the male form as a kind of generic form, if a writer were a free man and not a slave, if he could write what he chose, not what he must, if he could base his work upon his own feeling and not upon convention, there would be no plot, no comedy, no tragedy, no love interest or catastrophe in the accepted sense. So she wants to sweep aside all the conventions of literature. She doesn't want a plot in the accepted sense, you know, introduction, development, some sort of crisis, resolution. You know, she doesn't want any of that. She wants to try and represent how people's minds work, really. And the reason that she advances for that is in this famous phrase, life is not a series of gig lamps symmetrically arranged. Life is a luminous halo, a semi-transparent envelope surrounding us from the beginning of consciousness to the end. A series of gig lamps. Gig lamps are sort of regularly placed lamps along a driveway. So it's not just a question of constant illumination. It's much more mysterious than that, what she calls a semi-transparent envelope surrounding us from the beginning of consciousness to the end. And that's what she thinks a novelist's job is to represent. Okay, so that's a bit of a digression, but that's the context against which I think we need to read our modernist short stories, and in particular the ones that we're going to be looking at of Catherine Mansfield. So I'm going to move on to say something about Catherine Mansfield now. Are we all right so far? Yes? You're all with me? Yeah? Okay. Right. So there she is. You can see that it's a short life. She's 35 when she dies of tuberculosis. And she's born in New Zealand into a fairly well-off family. And a lot of those stories, particularly her early stories, are set in New Zealand. But at an early age, she moves to England, and after a return to New Zealand, she comes back as an adult and spends the rest of her life, the rest of her life in England. She actually travels about Europe quite a lot, but she is over here, shall we say, rather than New Zealand. She was an adventurous soul. She had a series of relationships, most of them seemingly doomed, with men and women. And I suppose the relationship that's I don't know about most significant, but the one which is kind of ensured her literary reputation is her relationship with John Middleton Murray, which I'll come to in a minute. She begins to publish her stories pretty early, 1910, so she's about 22 at that point. And she's publishing her stories in a magazine called The New Age. The New Age is one of those little magazines that are so significant in the modernist world. And The New Age, founded at the beginning of the century, was meant to reflect, you know, the newness of the new century and champion quite a few modernist writers. In 1911 she meets John Middleton Murray, who is the editor of another little modernist magazine called Rhythm, and she gets to know some other people within modernist circles. She gets to know D.H. Lawrence, she gets to know Virginia Woolf. Virginia Woolf, if you look at Virginia Woolf's diaries, is quite disparaging about Mansfield. She thinks of her as rather dirty. But, you know, I think quite a few scholars would suggest there's a certain amount of professional jealousy there, because Mansfield is doing things with a short story which are quite startling and quite new. She's diagnosed in 1918 with tuberculosis and suffers from that from the rest of her life and dies eventually of it, having published three collections of short stories. And there's more comes out after that. Largely edited by John Middleton Murray. So it's a very short but crowded life. You know, a number of significant relationships, as I say, with men and women. She also did an extraordinary thing during the First World War. She decided that it would be a good idea to go and view a battle, so she travelled to France and stood on top of a hill whilst a battle was raging below, which, you know, seems quite extraordinary to us now. But she did that. So she was quite a feisty and lively woman with a very kind of free attitude to life. And some of that is reflected, I think, in the fiction. So her reputation is based on almost entirely, I put entirely there, and I guess that's probably right, but there are some other aspects of her work which are being looked at and discussed more frequently now. But nonetheless, I think it's fair to say that those five volumes of short stories, and you know, you've got a good selection in this Oxford book. That's what her reputation rests on. In terms of critical work, secondary material on Catherine Mansfield, if you compare it to Virginia Woolf, then it's very slight. There isn't actually that much. There's enough, I think, for us, you know, to be respectable, as it were. But it's interesting that attention, in terms of modernist women, attention is focused almost entirely on Woolf. And I don't quite know why that is. It's a sort of trick of the canon, really. That if you look at the critical bibliography on Woolf, it's huge, it's absolutely enormous. Whereas some of the other modernist women, like Elizabeth Bowen, Catherine Mansfield, Jean Rhys, May Sinclair, etc., have comparatively tiny secondary bibliographies. However, there has been a revival of interest recently. The discovery of those unpublished short stories will help, I think. A new biography came out last year, so there is sort of growing interest in Catherine Mansfield. And perhaps one of the reasons why is because she has a slightly different take on how to represent female consciousness than Woolf does. And I think it's also clear that because she concentrated so much on the short story that she was instrumental in redefining what the short story was and is. And I just want to offer you a bit from a website run by the New Zealand government. You can imagine the New Zealand government are quite proud of Catherine Mansfield and her achievements. And they have this nice little paragraph about the qualities of her short story, which I think is worth sharing with you. She sought to capture the transitory vividness of life. Transitory vividness of life. So we're back with that idea of the art of the glimpse, aren't we? The seeing things just in snapshot mode. And to bring ordinary moments and people into focus so that their full significance could be understood. Accordingly, she rejected the conventions of the highly plotted narrative with a carefully wrought conclusion, instead using direct and indirect narrative and a rapid transition of tenses to provide constant shifts of perspective. So you need to be nimble as a reader when you're reading Catherine Mansfield's stories. The story will not unfold in a kind of set, conventional way, beginning, middle and end. It might not unfold from one particular perspective. So you need to be aware of that. Often there is a resolution but no definite conclusion, pattern but no plot. At times there is an almost cinematic quality in her work, perhaps a result of her interest in film and her occasional work as a film extra in England. That's interesting, I think, and it's something. There is actually a book about the relationship of modernism to film. And I think it's clear when we look at T.S. Eliot, for example, that we'll be able to see there are some cinematic techniques which seem to have been imported into literature. And of course, that's very much a new thing. Cinema, and certainly mass cinema, the idea of going to the cinema, going to the pictures, is a very new thing when our modernists are writing. And the grammar of cinema, the way in which films are put together, is developing all the time. And that has some interaction, I think, with modernist writing. This then goes on to say, her skillful use of these technical innovations constitutes a major advance in the evolution of the short story form. And I think that's true. that what you have with Mansfield is ultimately revolutionary. She has taken a form which, as we said, is actually quite a modern and relatively new form, and she's transformed it into something else, much more complex, much more challenging, and something which defies a lot of the few conventions that have been established up to that point. So she redefines the short story room. Now, some of the ways in which she does that, I suppose the first thing is the idea of exploring human consciousness. The idea, as we mentioned last week, of the emphasis on the internal rather than the external. Now, clearly, there's lots of external detail in these stories. You know, we're given information in Bliss. It's a dinner party, isn't it? And we hear about the preparation for the dinner party. We hear about the characters' thoughts about the dinner party as it approaches. When we get the dinner party, then we get a little incident at the end of the dinner party. So, yes, we've got external details. We've got a description of the house. We've got a description of the conservatory. Descriptions of the furniture and the flowers and so on and so forth. We've got external details. But the central thrust of the narrative is all about what's going on in people's minds. And, you know, in particular, we've got one central character in place and we want to know what's going on in her mind, Bertha's mind. So the central focus is this idea of human consciousness. And I mentioned May Sinclair there as somebody who's also exploring the same kind of thing. And, of course, Wolfe. You can never escape Wolfe in discussions like this. So what she's trying to do, I think, is take up the sort of challenge that Wolfe puts down in modern fiction and to think about new ways of conveying human consciousness on the page. And entering into the minds of her characters. So rather than have, even though the stories might well be written in the third person, it's not a detached point of view that you get. You get something that's much more about an exploration of an individual consciousness. That's at the foreground of the story. And the other thing that I think she does very well, she kind of deconstructs, if you like, is that idea of linear progression. So the idea of a chronological story which is going to present a series of events, beginning to end. Some of the stories do that. But others start in midpoint or start at the end and work backwards. She's not interested in that kind of orderly arrangement. She's interested much more, I think, in presenting the way in which a consciousness might develop, the way in which realization might dawn in somebody's mind, that kind of thing. So what all of that adds up to, I think, is a sense of the short story as being something which is in a state of flux, that it's a convention or a set of conventions which is ripe for challenge, in the same way as conventional poetry and in the same way as conventional novel was being challenged by the modernists generally. So, a couple of points to develop from that. Kate Fulbrook, in her book about Catherine Mansfield, which is called Catherine Mansfield, makes this rather big claim. She says Mansfield transformed the short story in England, in English, and did so along significantly modernist lines. The presentation of an unfixed and uncertain version of personality, communicated through unifying images and through extraordinarily tight control of narration. Just to unpick that a little bit, an unfixed and uncertain version of personality. So she's not dealing in stock characters. She's not dealing in a kind of fully formed figure that you might get in a novel. These are people in a state of flux all the time. The idea of unifying images Catherine Mansfield uses symbolism a lot. So I think when you're reading her stories and you wonder why a particular item is emphasized, so, you know, for example, in Bliss, it's the plant in the conservatory that gets a lot of attention. So if you're wondering about why that happens, then usually it's got a symbolic load. You know, there is some sense in which that item, that thing, whatever it is, assumes significance in the lives of the characters around them. So she's very keen on representing the sort of emotional atmosphere, if you like, through symbolic means. Tight control of narration, I think that's possibly a bit contentious, because what some people might say about some of Catherine Mansfield's stories is that, well, they're a bit rambling. You know, they don't seem to be tightly controlled. But I think in terms of the selection of the incidents and the way in which they're put together, then you could suggest that actually they are tightly controlled. And what they leave you with is perhaps more questions than answers. You're certainly not going to get the kind of neat conclusion with all the loose ends tidied up. And, you know, to go back to Bliss again, we end that story with Bertha making a startling realisation about her relationship with her husband and her husband's relationship with her newly found friend, Pearl. But what happens after that? Well, we don't know, because that's when the story ends. So we're left with this almost like a cliffhanger. You know, what's going to happen next? How is this relationship, this kind of three-way relationship, how's that going to progress? We don't know. We've got some clues based on what we've gleaned of the characters so far. But we're not offered that kind of closure. Well, thinking about how modernist is it, I think all of the time when we're thinking about the text that we're looking at, given, you know, what you've got to do in your assignments, then obviously the key question you've got to ask yourself is, well, what are the modernist characteristics here? You know, how is this text showing its modernism? I think there are a few things in Catherine Mansfield that you can relate to other modernist writers. If you look at Mrs. Dalloway or To the Lighthouse, Woolf's fictions generally, you'll see this emphasis on the representation of female consciousness and presenting that as a different thing, a matter of a different degree than consciousness in general or male consciousness in particular. Stylistic technique changes too. So if you think about Joyce and Ulysses, obviously one of the key things there is stream of consciousness. That attempt to represent without apparent intervention by an author. Obviously there is intervention by the author because the author is writing it down, but without apparent intervention, the raw thoughts of somebody, you know, those myriad things that Woolf goes on about in your head all the time. That's what stream of consciousness is. Joyce is the master of it. Some of our other writers will attempt to do something like that, and Mansfield is one of them. So she's taking some of that. This idea of interiority, in other words, representing consciousness rather than trying to represent the external detail of life. Sinclair, in a work like The Life and Death of Harriet Freeman, does that. Others of our writers try to do that too. The unreliable narrator. If you think about most conventional 19th century novels or prose fiction, then the contract that you enter as a reader is that what the narrator tells you is going to be accurate. So for the purposes of reading the novel, you kind of accept that, yeah, this is real, this is true. And of course, there have been unreliable narrators, and you can go back, you know, right to the start, beginnings of the novel, you go back to somebody like Moll Flanders, you know, notoriously unreliable narrator. But nonetheless, it's a relatively unusual device. I think in modernism it gets much more prevalent. And the idea of the text having authority, because it's by an author, gets undermined. So when we come to Ford's The Good Soldier, we'll see that in action. But you can see that in action too in Mansfield's short stories. So a short story like Je ne parle pas français, for example, which is narrated by this rather dubious, rather seedy, rather sordid pimp, really is what he is, the Frenchman, and I can't remember his name, in Je ne parle pas français. How far can we trust him? You know, not very, I would say. So, what we can say about Mansfield is that you take something from all of those writers, all of those different elements come together in her writing. But there's a few things that we can say which are perhaps distinctive about her work. The focus is always on relationships. It's always about that negotiation between people who are living together. You know, how do they get on? Is it about love? Is it about familial relationships? Whatever. It's about relationships. It's about people and their interactions. It's quite limited in terms of the social world that it conveys. Not quite as limited as some authors. You remember, you know, Jane Austen famously, can't remember who the critic was who said, but you know, that she writes on this kind of tiny little sliver of society, you know, that very precise bit of society that's kind of upper middle class but not quite upper class in Jane Austen's world. Catherine Mansfield isn't quite as restricted as that, but certainly you've got the New Zealand stories, which are largely about people in rural areas, you know, sort of gentleman farmer type families, that kind of thing. The stories set in England tend to be middle to upper class, you know, perhaps rather bohemian, urban people. There's a set of stories which is based on her travels in Europe called In a German Pension, where, obviously based on her own experiences, where she had a variety of settings in Europe. But again, you know, this is a kind of genteel upper middle class. So limited in scope, but you could say that about Joyce as well. You know, what did Joyce write about? Well, he wrote about, you know, a fairly well-defined group of people in Dublin. And that's it. You know, all of that work, Dubliners, Portrait of the Artist, Ulysses, Finnegan's Wake, it's all about a relatively tightly defined group of people. Doesn't mean to say that he's limited in what he does. The emphasis on the commonplace. There are very few stories where anything terribly startling happens. There's a couple where there's some, you know, rather disturbing moments, you might say, and we'll look at a couple of those in our classes this week. In The Garden Party, there's a death, but it's a sort of death that happens off stage. In Je ne parle pas français, the possibility of a girl's life being ruined, her being abandoned, you know. I'm not quite sure if that does happen, though, and that's one of the intriguing open possibilities at the end. So, you're not getting huge events, you are getting an emphasis on the commonplace, the daily lives of these people. And dealt with very much in terms of the internal world, that in the way that their minds work. And so what it means is that we don't get plot in the sense of this happens, so therefore this happens, so therefore that happens, and then we have a conclusion. We get a series of events which are driven more organically, if you like, by the ways in which people's reactions work. Okay, so are we all right on that? If I move on in conclusion to say a little bit about each of the stories we'll look at, and we'll follow that up in our classes later on. What are we doing for time? Right. Okay, so, Bliss. This is a good example, I think, of the business I was mentioning before, where you've got a third-person narration, But actually, everything that we read about is through the consciousness of Bertha. This rather, she's a bit of an airhead, Bertha, actually, isn't she? She's somebody who doesn't have much of a clue about life and has seemed to live a rather charmed life so far, which is now going to have a kind of rude interruption. The focus is very tightly controlled. You know, we're not rambling all over the place here. This is just one evening. So going all the way back to our definitions at the beginning, this is very tightly controlled. It's one event. This dinner party in their, you know, in their very nice Chelsea apartment. One evening, one event. But we do get some of those elements that we've mentioned. The symbolism, the pear tree that Bertha takes Pearl to look at, and subtle references to gender and sexuality. There's nothing overt here, there's nothing crude, there's nothing direct. But there are certainly enough suggestions about sexuality to raise some questions about how that's conveyed in the story. And maybe even that Bertha herself is realising something about her own sexuality in this story. In the garden party, we have a clash of cultures and sensibilities. In the garden party, you've got a sort of upper middle class group of people and a collision between them and the working class. And there is a very much a sense of these worlds colliding, but also remaining completely separate. It's one of the New Zealand stories, and the focus, again, is on a young woman, in this case, a very young woman, teenager, Laura, whose sensibilities are being shaped by the events that unfold through the story. And again, we've got that third-person narration, but everything we see is through Laura's, from Laura's perspective, her point of view. In wider terms, there is a kind of commentary on class difference here, you could argue. And there's also a certain amount of symbolism, which focuses on apparently innocuous details here. The flowers that are used in the house and the hat which Laura's mother insists that she wears. And one other thing that we'll look at, Je ne parle pas français, perhaps startling because of its frankness about sexual matters. I mean, given, you know, what was possible or what was expected in terms of what you could publish in those days, this is actually quite radical, quite daring, because it deals frankly with the matter of sex. And it deals frankly with the matter of rather sordid aspects of sex as well. The theme is, you know, we have yet again here an innocent, in every sense of the word, girl, and being placed in the adult world of corruption, and becoming alienated as a result. So some central modernist themes are coming out here about identity, about alienation from the world, and also, in more general terms, you know, about a willingness to approach the realities of sexual life in a franker way than say, a Victorian writer might have done. So we'll pick up on some of these themes in our session coming up now, and then on Friday we'll go into more detail, closer readings of those three short stories. So thanks for your attention. See you next time.